This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What do you need to get off your chest? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, develop positive coping skills, and much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ramdas today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ramdas.
After experiencing the transformative power of a regular meditation practice, it's natural to feel inspired to share this gift and guide others on their own journey of discovery through meditation. Join Buddhist teacher David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell, comedian and creator of the Netflix animated series The Midnight Gospel, for a free online event on Tuesday, May 7th at 6 p.m. Eastern Time. They'll discuss the profound practices of mindfulness in Dharma Moon's renowned mindfulness meditation teacher training program. Get certified by Dharma Moon to teach meditation, lead group practice sessions, and work with individual students. Visit dharmamoon.com/beherenow for more info and to reserve your spot for the free online event with David Nickturn and Duncan Trussell.
This is Ram Dass Here and Now, and I'm Raghu Marcus. Welcome. So, I want everyone to know that today is our kind of 2-month birthday. I say kind of because I don't know exactly, but it is around 2 months that we 2 months ago that we started the Be Here Now Network, the podcast network, from which you're hearing this podcast, or you're downloading and streaming from iTunes. And by the way, while you're up on iTunes, it'd be great to leave some comments about what you think about the podcast. And also, you can leave comments on the Be Here Now Network Ram Dass Here and Now page and let me know, and I'll share it with Ram Dass, whatever feedback or things you'd like to hear about. We'd like to accommodate and have a dialogue with you. So 2-month birthday, and want to thank you for the support. We've had some great initial support. Obviously, this is a Be Here Now Networks under the nonprofit Love, Serve, Remember, Ram Dass's nonprofit that represents Ram Dass and Neem Karoli Baba and the other teachers that we have on the network. And we also and continue, because we have to, continue to encourage you to use that Amazon link and bookmark it so that whenever you buy anything from Amazon, and we all do every week, it seems, I do, we can get a very small percentage, but it all adds up if enough people do it to help support the network and what we're doing under the Love, Serve, Remember aegis. Also, donations are great, obviously, but if you can make just like even a $9 recurring one, that's $180 a year, that's the magic guru number, that would go another long way to give us the kind of support we need for what we're doing here and helping support the teachers and the projects that we have. And we have a bunch of them, and you're going to be hearing more about them by email. And that's another thing. Please, please do sign up and become part of the Be Here Now email list so that you can be informed of the things that we have going. Obviously, next month's our big month to introduce the Heart Mind app and the Life in Balance course. We've got some extraordinary podcasts coming up from different walks of life, shall we say, and I'm going to keep it a secret until, so that's why you got to get on the email list so that you can hear about this. So I'm keeping it a secret for now. What else? Before I get into today's podcast, I do want to let everybody know a big thing that's happening on our sister website. Well, it's not on the website. What am I talking about? It's from Ram Dass. It's a new course, and this is the first public announcement of it. It's going to all of you that listen to Ram Dass Here and Now. And it's called Ram Dass is Being Here Now, an odyssey through the essential teachings of Ram Dass. It's an 8-week course that we spent almost a year, maybe 8 months, curating very specific talks from both audio and video, alongside of a wonderful guide that was created by Ram Dass's co-author in the last couple of books, Rameshwar Dass. And it is just so nitty-gritty essential for anybody who, and you know, some people say, well, I've listened to a million of these Ram Dass talks. Well, I think you'll find talks in here that you haven't heard, because we really went into the deep catalog. And also just the way that it's curated to really support weekly topics, from identity and perspective to witness and dealing with suffering and karma yoga and love and compassion. I'm just it's a very, very full agenda that I think many people will appreciate, whether you are new to Ram Dass or have been listening to Ram Dass for a long time. So that you'll look out for. It'll be announced both on the Be Here Now network list as well as ramdass.org. So there you go. That's it for today on the announcements. This talk from Ram Dass is around spiritual practices. I don't know how many times people talk to me about spiritual practices, just in conversational meeting people at different places, at the retreats and so on. And it's a toughie. And in this talk, Ram Dass jokes about it. I think he starts the talk off thinking, people think, I've got to meditate today. And he says, if you think you should meditate, you shouldn't. Don't go out and lust some more. Obviously a dramatic statement. And one that is very true for all of us at one time or another. And certainly in the beginning, you know, our minds get into it and we just think that we need to do this, that, and the other, and that we're going to have a result that's going to change everything. And I like to think of it more as a habit-forming ritual supersedes some of the habitual tapes that we run on ourselves all the time with, I have to meditate, or I'm bored. That's another one. Bored. I love, and Ram Dass in this thing, he talks about, instead of identification with being bored, make peace with being bored. That's a biggie. That is a biggie. Now, so the other thing is, what are the motivations to actually doing practices? Now, obviously, I mean, for me, looking back, it was just rampant unhappiness and depression about what in the hell this was all about, if I was just to adhere to the norms of the culture and the society that I was living in, and my parental influence and all of that. And so I started just reaching out. There must be something else. And obviously psychedelics, you know, I've said this a billion times, had a big play in it to realize the interconnectivity of everything, so there was something beyond the senses and the ego. But I want to read something to you that's I just had this book recommended by my good friend David Silver, and it's a book by the guy that introduced the Tibetan Book of the Dead. Evans Wenz was his name. And this is it's called the Good Wishes of the Adi Buddha, Samantabhadra. Okay, it's a little bit archaic, okay, the language and everything. It's translated in the early part of last century. But it's really worth taking a look at, related to why in the hell should we be doing any practice? The foundation of all is uncreated, uncompounded, independent, and beyond mental concept and verbal definition. So whatever the foundation of all, it's uncreated, and you, in other words, you can't understand it or talk about it in a rational way. Neither the term samsara, which means illusion, nor the term nirvana, which means gone beyond illusion, can be applied to it. So neither of those can be applied. To realize it is to attain Buddhahood. Not to realize it is to wander in samsara, in the illusion. So not knowing the foundation, beings from time immemorial erred. They made a big mistake, not knowing the foundation. They were overwhelmed by the darkness of unconsciousness, from which sprang ignorance and error. Immersed in error and obscured by ignorance, the knower, the I, became bewildered and afraid. So that's when arose the concepts I and others, us and them, together with hatred. Just think of this stuff when you think of the times we're living in right now. When these had grown strong, there was born an unbroken current of samsaric evolution. Then the five poisons of the obscuring passions, lust, anger, selfishness, delusion, and jealousy flourished, and there was produced an interminable chain of badass karma. That's my little addition. The root source of error among sentient beings is thus unconscious ignorance. And in virtue of the power of the good wishes of me, the Adi Buddha, not me, Raghu Marcus, may each of them realize the radiant, immaculate mind innate in every living thing. So that's a pretty damn good definition of why the hell we should practice, right? And here's another one. This is from the talk from Ram Dass. Change generates fear. Fear generates contraction. Contraction generates prejudice and bigotry and ultimately violence. What is the antidote for that? Is the unconscious? No. Okay. What is the antidote for that? It's the consciousness that does not respond to change with fear. The consciousness that does not respond to change with fear. And so how that's, to me, would be the perfect motivation for practice to develop compassion, love, unselfishness, and just a high motivation to get ourselves straight so that we are not living in this polarization of our lives. Because obviously the polarization of what's going on today in the world, what's going on in our country, is just really high-level polarization, right? And, and this is something else Ram Dass has said over and over. Until we straighten our hearts out, we can't think, there's no way that we can do much to help in any way. Just even the people right next to us, our family, our wives, husbands, brothers, sisters, mothers, girlfriends, boyfriends, workplace associates and all of that. Just think of all of that. Never mind the society in general. So in this talk, Ram Dass talks a lot about being honest, having an honest approach to the path, which is why he said when the question is, why do we do practices? And when you think you should meditate, don't keep, you know, go out there and run some of your karma off for a while. But basically what he's saying is really have an honest approach to the path, meaning an honest approach to where we're at, which brings in a little bit of awareness, the witness, mindfulness, whatever you want to call it, about our motivation. And if it is this motivation of getting ahead, and that we're going to meditate so we can, you know, we're going to get better, we're going to get anything, and then you realize that and you just sit. You just let go of the thoughts and you just create a habit. I mean, this is the way that I have done it. I don't think about it. I just sit, you know. I mean, this morning I went and sat, and I just traveled and just came back a couple of days ago, and a little time lagged, and, you know, tired. And I'm going to myself, I'm too tired. And then I slip into getting lost in thoughts because there is a little bit of fatigue. And then I keep remembering, you know, one great thing I remember from Sharon Salzberg is you remember that you're lost in thought. And the beauty is the opportunity to come back to the whatever your point of one-pointedness is, or absorption, however you're doing it. You can always come back. And so I would come back and not have a lot of recrimination and guilt because I was a screw-up for not being able to have any focus, you know, and not going on to myself, I'm tired, I'll just quit. So it's just a matter of creating a habit where you're not thinking about any excuse not to do it, or even the other side of it, where you have this fantastic inner experience of some sort of great absorption, and then, you know, there's pride and, you know, all of that that goes into that. So here it is. It's a spiritual practices. It's just, it's a lot of Ram Dass's perspective, which he's really good at giving about how to approach and what the meaning is of doing practices. And it's a pretty great talk. So this is Ram Dass Here and Now. I'm Raghu Marcus. Happy to be here with you again. And I'll repeat again, please go to BeHereNowNetwork.com and lend whatever support you can, and communicate with us, and get on the mailing list. And we shall see you next time.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. Stop for a moment and think about something that you really need to get off your chest. It could be frustration with your job or a coworker. It could be fear or uncertainty about the future. It could be a secret that you've been hiding for years. We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever is weighing you down. Speaking with a therapist on a regular basis is also a great way to improve your communication skills, learn to resolve conflict, increase your self-awareness and self-esteem, develop positive coping strategies, build stronger relationships, and more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Just fill out a brief questionnaire to get matched with a licensed therapist, plus switch therapist at any time for no additional charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit BetterHelp.com/Ram Dass today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/Ram Dass.
Now, the question is why you do practices, because a lot of people, like, they'll go away from this and they'll say, I ought to meditate. Forget it. Don't. Go out and lust some more. Go until you are so nauseated by your own predicament that you yearn to meditate. Get so hungry for it that you can't wait to just sit down, turn off the television, turn off the drama, and just be quiet for a few minutes. Wait until you really want it, because when you start with, I ought to, I should, you end up hating the practice, hating everybody, hating yourself. Then you cheat. Then you get guilty. It's a whole thing that you psychologically do. Forget it. You came here this weekend. That was an honest thing you did. You are here. What you hear, you hear. What you don't hear, you don't hear. Don't collect it. Forget it. It'll come around again. Another lifetime, maybe. Ah, no. Sure. Maybe 5, 10,000 lifetimes. Who knows? The problem of phony holy is a drag. I'm a master at it, I'll tell you. How to be phony holy. How to get ahead of yourself. Because we in our society think our way into stuff rather than slow down enough to let it happen to us in a natural way. I ought to meditate. I ought to get educated. I ought to. I ought to. You've always, many people have been living so much by the culture's defining what you ought to do. I mean, I got to be a Harvard professor by doing what I ought to do. And even then, I was doing what I ought to do to be a good Harvard professor. And it was only when I took mushrooms and I connected to something in myself that was true. It wasn't somebody saying I ought to be this, it was what I am. It was a certain quality of amness or isness. And I remember the moment when I was being thrown out of Harvard. When the chairman of the department and the dean had said to me, we can't save Tim Leary, he's too crazy, but we'll save you. If you'll just shut up, we'll save you because you're running a lot of programs and we need you. They thought they did. They found they didn't, of course. And so there was a faculty meeting at which they were discussing the irresponsible nature of introspective research, which was the way they were getting us. And all of our colleagues got up and denounced us roundly. And at the end, there was silence. And Tim was shocked because he thought everybody agreed with him all the time. And I remember feeling the moment that the society was telling me how I ought to be in order to something. But the inner truth was so deep in me that I was connected and I couldn't control. I stood up and I said, I'd like to answer on behalf of our project. And the chairman looked at me and I looked at him, and that was it. He couldn't save me anymore. And I remember the moment of choice. I mean, of illusion of choice, by the way. Don't kid yourself. It's not that great. I remember that moment at any rate. And the interesting experience of realizing how rarely I had trusted that inner place in myself in my whole life. I mean, you could look at this from a cultural point of view is he took drugs and he went psychotic. And then he didn't play the game of society and he got thrown out of a major social institution. There was a moment when I got thrown out when they had a big press conference and all the people were there and they were all looking at me like I was this great loser because I had taken on Harvard and lost. And what had happened to me inside was so deep and so true that to deny it would have been impossible for me to go on with my life. And I looked and I thought, I mean, I was a psychologist and a psychotherapist, and I thought everybody was looking at me like a loser, and I was thinking I've won. I thought, this is the definition of psychosis. They're all crazy. And I was right. See how much sugar you can get if you don't watch out. The beauty of a true spiritual journey is that it keeps unfolding from inside yourself. If you just wait a little longer, you'll see how hungry you are for integrity in your being, for a certain quietness, for certain clarity, for certain, and you'll, the tendency in our society is when there is dis-ease to grab another experience in order to reduce the dis-ease. I remember when I got into Burma to the cell, I had spent the day in my cell, the first day of my 2 months, meditating righteously and getting my sleeping bag right and my food containers and studying the spider at the window and all the things you do. And then I realized I had months yet to go. And I was bored. I was really bored. And boredom became my object of meditation. I looked at boredom. Instead of the identification, I'm bored, I thought, what is boredom? What does it feel like? What is it like? What does it mean to be bored? Instead of, oh, I'm bored. Most of us, the minute you're bored, you move to the next thing to avoid it, and you're left with that fear or dis-ease about boredom. It's interesting to make peace with boredom. Nothing's happening. Nothing's ever going to happen again. And here we are. And it's fascinating because when you pull back from a certain level of experiencing life, experiences, and see they're just more stuff, no matter how fancy packaged they are, they're just more stuff, you get to the point of realizing that when you are in here, you are here and you're not going anywhere and nothing's ever going to happen. And that's an interesting plane because you have been living on the plane of rushes and trips. And more trips, and more collecting, and more collecting. Is this too weird? Are you hearing it? Yeah. So that the timing of practices is interesting. And I mean, I'm put down a lot for being an eclectic slob because most traditions say you've got to go deep into a tradition to make it pay off. And I go as deep as a dilettante can go before I'm fascinated by the next one. So I'm a Buddhist, Hindu, Christian, Jewish, Muslim, blah, you know. Because I'll take anything that comes along that gets me to remember, that awakens me. And at first, it feels very multifrenic. But after a while, they all seem to be saying the same thing to you. It's like reading holy books. At first, you're really getting new conceptual structures and new ideas. And then after a while, you get to feel a redundancy of them. They're all saying the same thing over and over again. They're just different strokes for different folks. And it's good to have them around. They're like what's called satsang or sangha, meaning the community of beings on the journey. And it's great at the stage of awakening and establishing yourself in these deeper planes of awareness about who you are and what your universe is about to hang out with other people who look at the universe that way. It's extremely useful. And often you may not find those people right around you all the time. And therefore, you may turn to books or pictures or knowing, just reading the words of such beings, or reading the lives of such beings, or the quotes, or whatever. And they can do it through humor, they can do it through stories, they can do it through didactic teaching. And often it's sufficient. If I get up in the morning and I sit up in bed, and I might take one book of these little quotes or shlokas or paragraphs and read one of them and then just sort of sit with it and let it mishmash with my day. Sort of look at my day through those eyes.
And you've got in your packets a little such booklet with quotes and stories and things to reflect on.
Because this weekend is like a smorgasbord. It's a buffet. And you get a taste of all these different methods, practices, metaphysics, ways of doing it. And then you've got to trust your own intuitive heart as to what you listen to and where you go. Somebody will come and say, I have found the only way. And you say, I honor you for that. I've got to listen to my heart. If you don't trust your heart along the way, that's that game of learning to trust more and more strongly that the deepest inner message you can hear. Oh, so you sit down and you say, all right, I'm going to listen to my inner message. And you suddenly realize there are thousands of them. And each one is saying, I'm your real inner message. I am your real truth. Listen to me. Kill. And you see, culture's full of it. I mean, you see ethnic conflicts are people listening to their inner truths and willing to die for it. You see how entrapping the mind is, how incredibly entrapping the mind is. People get into a practice, the practice works, they get addicted to the practice, they try to get everybody else to do the practice because it works for them, they'll kill because other people won't do the practice. Isn't that far out? Imagine the Arabs and the Israelis, I mean, they're sisters and brothers in terms of the same God, and there they are beating the shit out of each other over their minds, over their mind trips. These are mind trips we're playing with. And we're all part of it. In our subtle way, we are all caught in these conspiracies of defining reality certain ways. And you realize it takes the individual. It's not going to be through the group process. It's going to be through each individual to extricate the awareness from the trap of these conceptual maps in order to draw back, in order to have the spaciousness to see the absurdity of the predicament of the traps of mind. I mean, I watch C-SPAN, and it's like watching Butthead and Beavis and Butthead, as far as I can see. I don't see a hell of a lot of difference. It's really bizarre, you know? I remember I was talking by fax and visiting with George Stephanopoulos, who's in the White House, and I said, George, in the White House, is there anybody that holds the vision or is quiet? Is there any silence? Is there any reflectiveness? Are there any elders? Is there any respect for the idea that the rational mind can't solve all the problems? And he said, no. I said, is there even the appreciation that it would be useful? He said, no. Now, that's not saying these aren't good people, by the way. I mean, George sees that predicament. He couldn't have answered my question unless he saw the predicament. But you've got to see the amount of attachment to something that attracts a person into a certain social role, and then to get that person to fill that role without being trapped by it. See, in the old days, and they weren't so great either, but in the old days, the kings had jesters and they had fools and they had wise people around to say, hey, you're getting a little caught in your kingliness, don't you think? Ain't nobody around now. There used to be at least Will Rogers. You know, Saturday Night Live doesn't do what Will Rogers did. It's a different level of the game. It's got to be a certain kind of compassionate satire. It's got to be humor that comes out of such love. It can't be humor that comes out of fear. And our comedies are full of humor that comes out of fear. Fear is what excites the adrenaline. Just look at the daily news. Look what's on it. Look what's on it. Love doesn't sell. No matter how hard you try, it doesn't sell.
People can't slow down enough to taste. Like you folks go out and you see the stars and it slows you down. And how many times do you even do that? How many times do you go in and turn on the lights and turn on the television or turn on something? You turn on, you tune in, and you drop out, but what you drop out of is the deeper truth into a linear storyline. Now, if you see the nature of if this metaphysics that we're talking about ego and the different levels of self, ego and soul and awareness or God or whatever, if you see those and you begin to see what the nature of your curriculum as a soul is, having taken birth on Earth, is to awaken out of the karmic illusions that you keep creating. And you draw your awareness back through whatever practices you use to do that. Then you look around, and at first you're satisfied to do a practice now and then. But I'll tell you what happens is once the hook is planted, it is inevitable and irrevocable. You can try to go back to sleep, but you can't quite fully do it once you've started to awaken. And finally, what happens is it becomes your life's work. And something like somebody will come up to me and they'll say, I'm not doing well with my partner. We're thinking of divorcing. Because my partner isn't growing the way I'm growing, and I want to go on with my, and I want a satsang. I want somebody that is growing with me. And I can see from where they're saying it, that at a certain stage of their spiritual practice, they could hear the answer that it doesn't matter because they would do work on themselves, working with somebody who wasn't awakening, and they'd do a different kind of work, working with somebody that was helping them awaken. In other words, you have a partner who every time you say, I'm doing spiritual practice, they say, oh, come on, cut the crap. Let's go to the movies. That's interesting work in terms of a fire of purification for your inner truth. And it's just as useful as you say, oh, the spiritual world is so great, and they say, come on, don't talk like that. Really get in there. See? That's a different level. What I'm suggesting is that after a while, everything in your life becomes grist for the mill of awakening. And your priorities change. Instead of, am I happy in this relationship? It's, am I happy? Am I awakening through this relationship? Am I awakening through my work? Am I awakening through this drive? Am I awakening through the way I'm taking care of my body? Is this, you begin to, the journey of awakening starts to dominate the terrain. And there is clearly an inner shift of priority. And then you start to use your life that way. Just to push just a little bit more. I know I'm giving you a lot, but I'm not giving you a lot. I'm unburdening myself of a lot. The quieter you become inside, the more you will pull back a little, extricate yourself a little bit from the reactive mode that we are in. We've all learned reactive modes with each other. Hello, how are you? I mean, we all have these incredible stories to play out. the quieter we get inside, or the more we get established in that witness or the soul, or and there's a subtle distinction between witness and soul, but I just really can't do it in a 2-day. It's just too complex to keep playing this subtler and subtler level. Because the soul is really a transpersonal concept, and the witness isn't really that. But as you develop this quiet place inside from which you see the unfolding of your life story, you begin to understand what I was talking about yesterday, about how your ego identity is made up of your participation in the web, in a kind of horizontal web that involves your roles and all of your reference groups. They help define your identity. So that when you, like I used to have a motorcycle at one point, and I had a Mercedes. This was when I was being a young professor, 1958, I think. And I used to, when you rode the motorcycle, you put on a black jacket and you spit and you look tough, see? And when you rode the Mercedes, you put on a houndstooth jacket and you put your pipe in your pocket and you had a cap and you looked aloof. I mean, there were certain clear role definitions. And what I used to do is, just for fun, I'd ride my motorcycle with my houndstooth jacket and my pipe, and I'd go into the repair place and I'd say, there's a squeak in there, which you're supposed to say, the left. And I'd go to the Mercedes Club of America meetings in my boots and leather jacket. And they'd hate me, because I wasn't playing the game properly. And I saw that when I chose, like at one point at Harvard, the Young Turks got together and they decided we shouldn't wear neckties in the faculty club. But there was a rule, and so there was going to be a confrontation. And they asked me to join, and I had to decide whether neckties in the faculty club was the particular issue that I wanted to go down fighting for. And as you're quiet, you listen in and you see that when you push against fulfilling your roles, there is a lot of energy involved. And when you get lost in them, there's a lot of energy involved. And there is an art form in learning how to be a participant in the systems of life and honor it. What does it mean to honor your identity as a member of an ecosystem? What does it mean to honor your identity as a member of a nation state? What does it mean to honor your identity? Like, I was born a Jew, and yet here I've been a Hindu, Buddhist teacher and bringing Eastern ideas back to the West. What about my Judaism? Well, in the past 5 years, I've really made a study of it. Not that, and the Jewish community says Ram Dass is returning to the fold. That's their problem, not mine. First of all, I never left it. And just because I was doing Hindu practices didn't make me less a Jew. But it was really interesting to see what it meant to honor that part of my genetic identity. What did it mean when my father was ill for me to reorient my life, to live in the basement of that house in an apartment down there to make sure he was well taken care of, because I was part of a family? What does it mean for me to be active in the political community because I'm part of a political structure? And you realize it keeps expanding outward when you're part of humanity, and then you're part of living species, and you're part of sentient beings, and you're part of etc. And finally, the quieter you are, the more you feel yourself like tuning or feeling your way into the unique nature of your incarnation. and you find yourself in a harmonious way at peace with it rather than pushing against it or grabbing it. You are, I'm wearing this shirt, this Seva shirt, but I'm not the shirt. But I'm wearing it and it's serving its function and I'm doing it appropriately. So when people say, what should I do with my life? The more interesting question is, how do I cultivate the quietness of my being in which what I should do with my life will become all too apparent? You'll hear exactly. And don't be afraid of making mistakes. The journey is a constant hearing as well as you can the inner voice, making a choice to take an action. Take the action. The minute you make it, you feel it is disharmonious with some other plane of existence. And you go back inside again. The art form of continually emptying to hear freshly. Boy, imagine being in a relationship where everybody, where the two people are freshly meeting each other all the time. Imagine how freeing it would be for you. I mean, when you think of it, you and I are many, many planes of existence. Like if I had said to you when we were going to do this ritual with the beads, this is a ritual, and I want you to enter into it as if you pull back and be your soul. And we're going through this form in our bodies, but we are soul meeting soul. And then we go through the ritual together from a different plane than if we don't say that and come up and we meet in our personalities. Now, sometimes I'm in one place, sometimes I'm another. When I meet somebody, they say, oh, I know Dick, or I know Richard, or I know Ram Dass, and they peg me into a model, and their minds define it for their efficiency. He's who I always thought he was. So if you came down to breakfast one day and you turn out to be the Divine Mother, but somebody else thinks of you as somebody who didn't do the garbage last night, you begin to see how the conspiracy of mind defines reality, you know? You can use your membership into groups as a spiritual practice by exploring the power of your boundaries, because the whole issue of awakening into has also the quality of expanding to embrace more and more of the universe. And you can embrace it and keep the same control as a separate entity in relation to it. There has to be a dissolving of a certain boundary in order to be part of another kind of a thing. Like, my work requires me constantly to be emptying so that I become more of an instrument for some other kind of wisdom or presence or force. It's true for each of us. And my job is to continually get out of the way. And it's interesting in my business to use personal stories impersonally. I mean, I use my personal life because it's anecdotal and it's easy to get to, but it has nothing to do with me particularly. I don't take it personally. And it's really interesting. The soul does not take the ego's trip personally. Like somebody comes up and says, you're really a disappointment to me. I figure that's their problem. I may take it and work with it and look and see in the total warp and woof of things, am I a disappointment? And I either say, you know, they got something there, I'll clean up my act, or I say, no, it's the projection of their mind. If I'm not mindful, I will react initially. What do you mean I'm? Or, well, I think you are. Well, whatever you do. To escape from reactivity is such an art form. Such an art form. you and I are at this moment living in an increasingly you and I are living in shifts in the meta structures of the game we're living in that are so profound, like the information age. We haven't even begun to grow into it. Our mythology is so much based on previous age consciousness. We just haven't even understood yet. I mean, we're just starting with multinationals. I mean, we're just beginning the dance of understanding what it means when you have collective consciousness, when you have information moving at the rate it is. We're still getting overloaded trying to collect it when it's obviously you can't collect it. You and I are in a situation of very dramatic change. And the interesting question is how you respond to change. Whether it's in your own body or whether it's in the social structures you're in. What happens when the family breaks down? What happens when the government isn't functional? What happens? What happens when your IRA isn't as good as it was? Well, it doesn't work. Feel the chill run through you. You know. It's interesting to look at whether change is your friend or your enemy. Whether you can find a place in yourself from which you can see phenomena changing without being trapped in the fear that is generated by being identified with that which changes. That's what the issue is. You and I are not only here in terms of the work we're doing on ourselves. We are here in terms of the role we're playing within the systems of which we are part. And if you look at the way change affects people that are unconscious, change generates fear. Fear generates contraction. Contraction generates prejudice, bigotry, and ultimately violence. And you can watch the whole thing happen. And you can see it happen in society after society after society. And what is the antidote for that is the consciousness that does not respond to change with fear. That's as close in to the beginning of that sequence as I can get. And I'll tell you, the deepest one is the fear of death.
This podcast is brought to you by the Love Serve Remember Foundation and Ramdas.org. We appreciate you listening and we appreciate all the support that you've given us. Please continue that support and donate at Ramdas.org. We can then continue to share what Ramdas has been sharing for all of these years. Thank you.
This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. What do you need to get off your chest? We all carry around different stressors, both big and small. When we keep them bottled up, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest and to figure out how to work through whatever is weighing you down. It's also a great way to learn to resolve conflict, develop positive coping skills, and much more. If you're thinking of starting therapy, give BetterHelp a try. It's entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/Ramdas today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, H-E-L-P.com /Ramdas.